afternoon. We have with us this afternoon students from the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. They are students that are in a history class and are concentrating on the Wisconsin State Constitution, in part because of the sesquicentennial celebration. And I would like you to rise, please, with Professor Oberle. Would you stand up? Good. Well, welcome. You may be seated. Justice Crooks and I met with the group during the lunch hour to discuss a variety of matters. Now that you've been introduced to the court, I would like to introduce the court to you. At my far left is someone you know already, Justice Crooks. And to his right is Justice Jeanine Geske. And to my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, Chief Justice, as you know, we've met. To my right is Justice Donald Steinitz. His right, Justice John Wilcox. And at the far right is the Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. We have, as our last case for today, case number 97-2946, which is Marinette County versus Tammy C. The petitioner appellant is Marinette County. Counsel, are you ready to begin? You may stand at the podium and begin.
Yep,
you start, whoever you are.
What did they get up to?
Chief Justice Abramson, Associate Justices, my name is Charles Minerman. I am the guardian ad litem in this matter, and I appear as the co-appellant for the real party in interest in this particular case, the Marinette County Department of Human and Family Services. My remarks will be brief, as brevity is the soul of clarity. I have been the guardian ad litem in this matter since the inception of this case, since the children first came within the jurisdiction of Marinette County Human Services. However, I represent in the court that the interests of my wards, and it is the role of the guardian ad litem to protect the children's legal rights in court, as well as promote their best interests. In this particular case, the role of the guardian ad litem is totally aligned with that of the Department of Human Services, and accordingly, the bulk of the argument will be made by Mr. Stoffiker on behalf of his client, the department. I would, however, be remiss as the guardian ad litem were I not here today. I have collaborated on the briefs with Mr. Stoffiker, and once again, it's because our positions are totally aligned, and that you will find that in the record from the trial court, such as the record is. And we wish to avoid the redundancy of argument. However, it is in the best interest of my ward, and I represent this to the court, that we were not able to make a total record in the trial court due to the voluntary dismissal. I urge this court, in the best interest of my wards and of children in similar proceedings all over the state, from now on, to allow us to go back to the trial court and make the appropriate record replete with the allegations that the department hopes to prove. The respondents' argument in their briefs that the matter may be returned through an annual CHIPS proceeding could be valid. But we do not feel so. We feel that we need to make a record for a permanent termination of parental rights in this matter. The only way to do this is for this court to overturn that dicta in the case that currently controls, and the reason why we're here, bypassing the Court of Appeals, that is, in the matter of DF. I now yield to my colleague, Mr. Stoffiker.
Now, before you sit down, tell me what the dicta is that you're talking about.
Oh,
you want to tell us? Okay, now we can get to you, Mr. Stoffiker.
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice Abrahamson, Associate Justices, good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Chester Stoffiker. I am the Corporation Counsel for Marinette County. In that capacity, I represent the Marinette County of Human Services. The Marinette County of Human Services Department has been supervising CHIPS petitions for the two children involved in this appeal for several years. One of the children, Anthony C., has now just recently become 8 years old, and the other child, Joseph C., is now approximately 5 1/2 years old.
So how long have they been involved in this total process?
That's exactly what I'm coming to, Your Honor. These children have been in foster care since August 11, 1993. The first CHIPS actions were commenced in Waupaca County, where the parents and the children resided at that time. There were some CHIPS proceedings. Eventually, the parents moved to Marinette County, and Marinette County assumed jurisdiction. These children have been in foster care from August 11, 1993 until now, with two brief exceptions which were noted by the respondents in their motions and briefs. These two exceptions took place in very late 1994 or very early 1995. For a short time, the children were returned to the parents' homes. They were removed fairly rapidly and returned again to foster care, and they've been there ever since then. Now, the Human Services Department of Marinette County has been supervising these children, and in the course of executing their duties, they determined that it was time to give these kids a life. It became apparent to the Human Services social workers that the parents were not going to comply with the conditions ordered by the court in the juvenile proceedings for the return of the children to the home. Therefore, as of April 14th of last year, 1997, the legal proceedings were commenced to terminate the parental rights of both parents, which would eventually lead to placement for adoption. So the kids were getting old enough for that now. However, in the course of the various CHIPS proceedings since 1993, it appears that at least two of the orders as to each child, that is four orders total, did not have the proper TPR warnings required by the statutes. This fact is not disputed.
I was going to only ask, so how many orders did have the written required language in it that the parents received?
There's approximately six or seven orders. The latest two orders in each, as to each child, did have the proper language, but some of the earlier orders did not.
Did the first orders have them, the orders that were first entered? The initial orders, the first time the children were removed.
My recollection is they didn't have the proper TPR.
They did not?
They did.
They did.
They had the proper TPR warnings. But in subsequent orders, in at least two cases as to each child, they did not have the proper TPR warnings.
How many orders are there total here?
My recollection is either six or seven as to each child. It was an annual renewal thing.
When your associate counsel mentioned that I think the Chief Justice was going to ask, the holding of DF is basically that's the fatal defect, that if you don't have it, so that's really not dicta, that's the holding of that case, DF. And as I understand it, you're asking that we either overrule DF or find that substantial compliance is adequate?
That's my next point, Your
Honor. Well, I'm following you right up then.
You're just ahead of me.
Okay.
In the course of prosecuting...
Counsel, can I...
Sir,
I want to stay here just for a moment. Because of the answers that you gave to both the Chief Justice, you said at least six or seven, and to Justice Geske, that you thought maybe the first order had it. I am concerned that maybe the record, because you don't seem to know, maybe we're not going to be able to find out from the record. Are we going to be able to find out from the record whether or not the first CHIPS order had the proper warning? Are we going to be able to find out from the record how many actual CHIPS orders there were?
The respondents filed a motion to have all of the juvenile records included in this record, and that was approved by the Court of Appeals, so I believe you have all those records available to you.
And have you looked at the record?
In the past, I have looked at them. I don't have them with me. Okay. My recollection is that the first one had a detailed order with a detailed recitation by the court as to the TPR warnings. It was subsequent orders in the course of renewing these things that the TPR warnings were not included. But I believe you have all those files available to you here. Now, in the course of proceeding with the termination of parental rights litigation, we ran into a wall. And that wall is the DF case, which is recited. Specifically...
You have to stand in front of the microphone so that you will be recorded.
Thank you. Specifically, one sentence in the DF case, which I wanted to read, which appears to be in the context of being tacked on as an afterthought, but it is in the case and it is law at this time. That sentence reads as follows. Second, a continuing need for protection and services can be a basis for involuntary termination of parental rights only if the statutory warning required by section 48.356 parens 2 stats is given each time an order places a child outside his or her home pursuant to sections 48, 30, 345, 357, and other sections.
What page are you reading from?
I've got the West Reporter here that appears to be on page 613 of
it's 498
to 499 on... Wait, excuse me, that's on 614. It actually bridges between 613 and 614.
Thank you very much.
This is the wall we hit, and pursuant to that case, Judge Tim Duquette concluded that since two T's were not dotted in each case, that the parental rights determination proceeding could not go ahead. Therefore, there never was an evidentiary hearing of any kind, as has been noted by the guardian ad litem. Now, whether it's dicta or whether it's not dicta, it's still in the case, it's still the law, and the specific reason we're here is to ask you to overrule that portion of the DF case.
Why should we?
Sir?
Why should we? Doesn't it make sense? Well, it seems to me what the DF court was saying there, I don't know if I believe this, understand, I'm just putting this forth so you can respond. But what it seems to be saying there is that because of the fact that there are a lot of CHIPS petitions being filed, that alone can be sufficient grounds for a termination proceeding, that you have to put them in there to let the parents know. What's wrong with that?
Because the way I read the DF case, the sentence I just read, if you don't have every I dotted and every T crossed every time, you cannot terminate parental rights because of the specific ground of continuing need of protection and services.
But you certainly don't consider warning a parent that their child might be taken away from them as a dotting of an I or a crossing of a T, do you, counsel?
It has to be in writing. And that was determined by the appellate court in... Eric C.K. case in 1992.
Mr. Stauffacher, what would stop the department from getting a dismissal of the present orders that are in effect and immediately thereafter petitioning the court for a new order in regard to CHIPS or protection of the children and the need for services, and then proceeding after that, giving the proper TPR warnings with the termination procedures?
I touched on that in my brief. Basically, that is an alternative. However, if you terminate your CHIPS proceedings, then the Department of Human Services loses jurisdiction, at least for some period of time. The children are entitled to go back to the parents. And I think you would need a new factual basis, which would mean some sort of abuse or neglect situation. I don't think that would be in the best interest of the kids, and I believe the guardian ad litem would strongly advocate against that activity.
Could you cover that type of a gap with an emergency order?
If you had a factual basis for it. The factual basis is non-compliance or abuse or neglect.
Are the children presently in foster care?
Yes, sir.
So what you're saying, if I understand, is that the only way that the children can get back into the system, system being involved in some type of CHIPS or a termination, is something bad happens. Is that what you're saying? Something that would bring it to the attention of your department?
In the practical sense, that's what I'm saying. I don't see the alternative as being realistic or feasible or acceptable for the children's sake.
Let me return to the area of question that Justice Babbage was asking you about. You concede, do you not, that the court has an obligation in each order to give the TPR warnings?
There's no question about that. The statute's very clear.
And your position is, if they don't give it, there's no remedy for the parent? That they can have their rights terminated anyway, even though they weren't warned, or they were warned once, or what are you arguing?
Well, that's my next point.
Good.
Okay. The issue in this case is very simple. It's a single issue, and it's technical, but it's not too technical. Okay, we've got statutory language construction here, and that's what I'm getting at. In the ground for termination of parental rights for continuing need of protection and services, which is a specific ground, in this case it means foster care, the language requires that the written TPR warning be included. The magic words here from the statute are pursuant to one or more court orders.
And you're citing from 48452A, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, ma'am, I am. My contention in this case is that this particular phraseology on its face does not require the requirement imposed by the DF case that every order have every I and dotted and T crossed. That is my position.
I would like to ask you, what section do these orders come under? It says, pursuant to one or more orders under, and then has a list of sections. Which section does this come under?
The one that Justice Bradley just recited. The first, it would be the second paragraph.
No, but you're referring to 48.356. The Chief Justice is asking, what are the grounds? Which are the grounds for the order?
48.415 says, and that's the one you were reading, 48.415-2A, right?
Yes, ma'am.
It says, pursuant to one or more court orders under Section 48.345, 48.357, 48.363. Which of those sections are we talking about here?
This would be 345. It could be, for our purposes, it could be any of them. The issue is, does pursuant to one or more court orders require that every single order in the progression have the written TPR warning attached? Now, if you compare this with the other ground, the other commonly used ground for termination of parental rights, which is abandonment, and that is in section 48.415(1)(a), the language in that statute relevant to our purposes here is by a court order containing the notice required by section 48.356(2). Okay, now the question, and the courts have held, let me give you a reference here. Looking for the right word. I have an unpublished case here that's right on point, which says...
perhaps not. That's against the rules.
Pardon me?
It is against the court rules to cite an unpublished case.
This is the problem I have. We have published cases that go one way. We have unpublished cases that go several ways. And I recited these references in my brief. I recite these not as precedential authority, but only for the limited purpose of demonstrating to the court that we have diverse results out there. And I think one of the reasons this court took this case on bypass was to straighten that out, because according to the Cook case, this is the only court that can deal with this issue.
Counsel, what if, I'm asking a hypothetical now, what if none of these orders had contained the warning? Would your position still be the same, that this is a crossing of the I, or crossing of the T's and dotting of the I's?
No, what I would submit in that instance, that there, in the progression of CHIPS orders, whether it be two, three, or four, or however many, at least one order has to contain the proper warnings. And that's the situation for the abandonment ground.
But suppose that the last one is the only one that contains that notice. How long does that last order last?
That's the situation in this case. The last orders against each children do contain the proper notice.
And how long does that order? I mean, the order has a date that it expires, right?
These orders run for 1 year.
1 year. So then you've got a year to theoretically know what your rights are and correct them, correct any defects. Is that right?
That's the position I would ask this court to take.
Counsel, are you coming back?
Go ahead,
okay. Counsel, almost by definition, many of the people that are the subject of these orders are not very sophisticated people. And at least, let me put it to you sort of as an argument. It seems to me that if a person gets this order, the second order says it, you know, gives the warning, but then the next three don't. Can't it also be, isn't it a very pretty easy inference to draw that the person reading the order thinks that this no longer can result in the termination? And that, what I'm positing is, isn't it almost worse to give it in the second one rather than the last one?
Well, it's required. The statute requires...
I know, but I'm talking about these people who, obviously the legislature intends that parents be given some warning before their kids are taken away from them. And if they're given that warning in 1994, that this proceeding says that under this proceeding, you're in danger of having your child taken away from you. And then next year they get another warning that reads almost the same, but it doesn't say anything about having their children taken away from you.
Doesn't that create problems in your mind that these people may woefully misunderstand the peril that they are in?
That's half of the problem. It's bigger than that. The problem is the fact of the matter is the courts often gloss over these things and don't go into detail.
What do you mean they gloss over and don't go into detail?
I've been in court when it's happened, and the court will say, oh, by the way, it's possible you may lose your parental rights if you don't comply with these orders.
And what do the orders contain, the conditions? Because 348.356.1 says this order not only has to orally inform of that there may be grounds for termination, but it also has to orally tell them that what conditions there are for return of these children. And then you have to put that in writing, too.
The written part is a critical part.
I understand that, but...
Typically what happens is you'll see them attached to the petitions. In this case, you've got basically a form order that has multiple grounds for termination on it with little boxes to check, and the court will check one or more of these boxes. And then behind that follows a list of conditions that they have been expected to comply with.
Who makes up the conditions?
The Human Services Department, the social workers do. The court is required to check the box, though. That's given to the... In fact, one of the cases says you don't even have to serve it on the parents. But even if you did, you've got that problem. Are these people who are mostly unsophisticated capable of reading that and understanding it? The answer is, in a lot of cases, probably not.
Yeah, but in this case, they didn't even get it, so they could have taken it to someone to have it explained.
They have that option. Does it get done? I don't know. I suspect not very often.
Parents have lawyers here?
Yes, they both had attorneys. Both attorneys made the motion to dismiss, which is in the court, in the file available to you.
I mean, during the CHIPS proceeding.
I personally can't answer that. I wasn't present at the
right.
CHIPS proceedings.
Thank you. Now, 48.356.2 and 1 would indicate that every order needs to be. Has this information. If you look at 2, in addition to the notice required under 1, which is the oral notice, any written order, and it applies to 48.345. Now when you get to 48.415, which also applies to 48.345, it says one or more orders. That's a conflict. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Also, this court addressed this issue in the case of Jamie L., where it determined that 48.365 was not ambiguous. But what Jamie L. did not do was to say what happens when 48.356 sub 2 is not complied with. And that's the point where that's why we're here today. What is the result when it's not complied with? My request to this court is to overrule that portion of BF so that if there is one or more orders in the progression of CHIPS orders that does have the proper TPR warnings, written warnings, that the parents have been properly notified.
In that, in the DF case, the trial judge characterized it as substantial compliance. In other words, would that be the standard? It would be a... If one or more, that would be substantial compliance with the requirement of notice.
That's what the trial judge did. Yes. The circuit or the court of appeals reversed.
Right.
Let me ask you about DF. Are you at one point you're characterizing it as dicta, but is it your view that case was correctly decided, consistently with what you're arguing, or that it was erroneously decided?
I think DF was erroneously decided.
So you're asking to reverse that holding and not just eliminate what you might characterize as dicta.
DF stands for two basic, as I understand it, DF stands for two basic concepts. Number one, DF says that the warning has to be specific about which grounds are applicable. You can't give them a shotgun list of grounds. And number two is that if you use the continuing need of protection and services ground, every order has to be perfect. Now, in Jamie L., this court said that the first part, that the orders had to be specific, was dicta. Why it wasn't overruled, I don't know. So in my opinion, for the practical purposes of us out in the field, half of DF has been taken out of the legal jargon. The other half is why we're here, and I'm asking to have that half taken out also.
Now, what about in interest of KK? Do we have to do something with that case to be convicted? That's the Court of Appeal decision that compares the abandonment notice for the 1 year, the one notice for abandonment as opposed to the multiple notices that...
That's the dichotomy I was talking about earlier. If you use the abandonment ground, it's treated one way. If you use the continuing need of protection and services ground, it's treated the other way. Why? Because the language is different.
Do you think KK is wrong also, at least in reference, when it distinguishes the abandonment grounds from the continuing need of placement grounds? It distinguishes DF from situation in KK.
It does.
And says these are two different statutes and they have to be read differently. And your argument is, no, they are in fact the same, that only one order has to contain the warning.
That's my position. Yes, the statutes have different languages in them, but I don't think that difference makes a difference. I think my time is done.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
According to my notes, Mr. Kaczynski is going to argue.
Chief Justice Abramson and members of the court, may it please the court, Attorney Barbara Cadwell and I were appointed to represent the two respondents, Tammy C. and Anthony C., following the dismissal of a termination of parental rights petition in Marinette County Circuit Court by Judge Duquette in September of last year. We are dividing our responsibilities for the argument on a basis of issues. I'll be talking primarily about the legislative history that allegedly justifies the court doing what the appellants are asking the court to do, overrule DF. Ms. Cadwell is going to be talking primarily about the facts of the case, which she's had the opportunity to examine. Both of us have been in this case a lot less time than the counsel for the appellants in this case. It's our position that the decision made by this court in 1988 in the case of DF was sound statutory interpretation at that time, and that nothing, absolutely nothing, has happened since that time that justifies this court making any change.
That was a Court of Appeals case.
Which one, Your Honor?
Yeah.
DF.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
You're in the Supreme Court.
Right. I'm in the other court often enough, too. I think that decision was correctly made at that time, and I don't think anything has happened since then that justifies any type of any change in that.
Well, counsel, let me try something. In my reading of GF, there is a balancing of the interests that are set forth in Chapter 4801 prior to 1995. DF and KK are prior to 1995. And in 1995, under 4801 sub A, you have a balancing of the rights of the children to have fair hearings and parents, and also the constitutional rights of the parents is balanced into what is the legislative purpose of Chapter 48. Preserving the unity of the family is also part of that balance under 4801. But lo and behold, what we have in 1995, we have a change of that. And now under 4801, the legislature has said that the purpose of Chapter 48, the paramount purpose, is the best interest of the child. These other elements, the rights of the parents, preserving the unity, are to be considered in construing what is paramount, the best interest of the child. It strikes me that the result that your opposing counsel speaks of, that is, that the children have been out of the home and continuing need for protection and services for years, but can't get the rights terminated because one prior order doesn't have a warning, and that if what they say is true, that the remedy is the kids have to be put back in the home and you have to wait for the parents to have a new bout with alcoholism or whatever that was the reason for the initial stuff. But that is absurd. That is not in the best interest of the child. And it seems to me it's statutory construction is that you
have to interpret it in the context of the legislative purpose. The legislative purpose has changed since 1995. The rights of the children and the rights of the parents are no longer on equal footing, according to the legislature. And therefore, perhaps, DK can be distinguished. Did you respond to that argument?
I'm glad you asked, Your Honor. This court, in the interest of JBL, this court found that that particular section of the statute we're talking about, 48.3562, is unambiguous. If you have an unambiguous statute, you don't have to worry about the legislative history. But I think the court's referring, I think, to
1990.
Pardon, Your Honor?
What's the year of JML's decision?
JML's 1992. Also, Your Honor, before that decision was made, part of it was there was an amendment to the statute, and the court took the basic idea that if the legislature changed the statute, didn't change a certain section, that they would have thought about the possibility of changing something if it was a problem. But I think the court's referring to the 1995 Wisconsin Act 275, and in fact, I brought it here, Your Honor, the legislative history for that act about 3.5 inches thick. This was a legislative council proposal. There were a total of 43 witnesses, 13 meetings that were held in this particular statute on this particular bill. Nowhere, anywhere in the legislative history of Act 275 are the problems that are concerning the appellants even dealt with, are even considered to be a problem by anybody. The legislator in that legislature in Wisconsin Act 275 considered the whole realm of TPRs and CHIPs and didn't touch this section except, as is noted in the brief, they added an additional warning requirement for abandonment that in fact increases the due process protection for parents beyond what they had statutorily before Wisconsin Act 275.
My comment is then that, you interpret a statute in the context of the totality of the statute. Here, since 1995, the legislature has very purposefully, apparently, according to the articles, said that now of paramount importance is the best interest of the child. Well, that was a major change in focus. That was discussed, my recollection is, although I haven't gone through legislative history, just from the following the legislation. When I read DF, I see several references to the requirement to give the warnings is in furtherance of the parental rights. And there is in DF a balancing of rights. And I submit that maybe the balancing inquiry that existed prior to 1995 is different now. The antecedent inquiry to DF is different since the balance has now changed.
I guess that's an argument, that's certainly the argument that the appellants made, but I think we also have to consider the principle that when the legislature amends a statute, it's presumed to know the court decisions relating to it. The legislature knew about it, they researched it to death, and didn't touch this particular section. No one even at the hearings even considered this to be a problem. I think the legislature, as I pointed out, in the briefs, they amended the substantive grounds for terminating parental rights, made them much more liberal than they had before, but the legislature also recognized the need for due process and termination of parental rights proceedings and maintained the due process and, in fact, increased the due process. The idea is we protect children, but we don't throw away the Bill of Rights while doing it.
Well, this case is very troublesome. On the one hand, you want to protect the parents, clearly. And the statute does that. And in one provision of the statute, it says every order, any order, to put in the notice. We got other statute that says one or more orders, which doesn't sound like any order or every order. And you've got to protect the child. And the logical consequence of your position is you have to send the child back to the family. And in order to file, as I understand it, a new petition, a new CHIPS petition, you got to wait until you find out that something's the matter with that house. Right?
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Okay. Why not?
Because based upon the history of non-contact or minimal contact and the past history of this case, the department could perhaps, if it terminated the prior CHIPS orders, initiate a new order, initiate an emergency TPC termination or temporary physical custody order, and have a hearing. The parents would be entitled to a hearing within 48 hours in front of a circuit judge or a court commissioner on the issue. And it may well, they may well decide in that case, that situation, that there are grounds for holding the children.
You said perhaps.
That's without any incident, without anything happening other than they simply, on their own, do a petition. Is that what?
Correct. And depending on the circumstances of each individual case, there may be new things that have happened. Perhaps since the original CHIPS order was initiated, the parents have had more additional incidents of criminal conduct or alcoholism or
but
mental.
If there's nothing new, counsel, nothing has happened except there has been this defect that we're discussing here today, you're saying that the department then can, on their own, start another action, issue the order without anything happening.
Well, the problem, Your Honor, is with children, there's always, if nothing happens, in effect, something happens, because there either is or has not been, for example, visitation between the parents.
Okay,
and
let's
children.
Suppose there's been no visitation. Parents are still doing whatever it was that they were doing, and you win this case, and nothing's changed in that household. Everything's exactly as it was when they removed the children, ongoing. Where do the children go if you win this case?
Frankly, Ms. Cadwell probably knows the facts of that particular issue more than I do, but I guess it would be up to the court. I would imagine the department would petition. I've had cases where I've had CHIPS cases dismissed with the department's petition immediately after the dismissal based on new conduct.
And what happens to the department's petition?
The new petition. Again, it depends.
Okay, it depends on the circumstances.
Right.
What we've got is a situation where you can have six orders and one doesn't have this notice, and six do, five do. Are you going to just chuck the whole thing for that defect? Isn't it better to say you've got to show prejudice? You've got to show your clients didn't know that they could have changed their circumstances, but they didn't.
I think
I'm trying to find a solution which is not all or nothing in this circumstance.
I think the forum for coming up with that solution, Your Honor, is with the legislature and not with the courts. The termination of parental rights and child protection matters are within the province of the legislature, who's reviewed the matter extensively.
Now, let me ask conflicting statutes.
Let me ask you a question. Let's assume today, let's assume there was a valid order entered with warnings 12 months ago, but earlier on down the road, years ago, one of the orders didn't have one. Your position is, today, if the county wants to proceed to a termination of parental rights, they have to dismiss the whole thing and start it over, right?
Yes.
And give the warnings. Now, what's the earliest time they can start a termination of parental rights proceeding based on that?
Based on the current statute, I would believe it's now 6 months of non-compliance with the.
So if an order was issued today with the warnings, they could start one in a year.
Right.
Even though there was an order issued 12 months ago with the warnings, and your argument is they can't start it on that one because there was an earlier order with no warnings.
Exactly.
Does that make any sense at all? They get an order with warnings, and in 12 months, it's good for 12 months. And at the end of the 12 months, the county proceeds to TPR, and whether they can proceed or not proceed depends on what happened some date that precedes that order a year ago. I mean, in either case, your client 5 years ago got one without warnings, and then 12 months ago got one with warnings, but they'd have to dismiss and start one more with 12 months with warnings as opposed to extending it with warnings. And I guess maybe you can explain this to me. What is the difference between starting a new one with warnings or extending the old one with warnings in terms of notice to your client?
I think it's not so much an issue of notice to the clients as it is of following proper legislative procedures and following proper due process. Termination of parental rights should be difficult. This court has held that on numerous occasions.
But in each case, 12 months ago, they were given warnings, whether or not they previously were or not. I mean, I'm arguing with him. I didn't mean to do that. But it seems I can't see that. I don't understand the fundamental difference. I mean, the whole purpose of this is to give notice to your clients. And if the notice is the same in either case, it doesn't make sense to me.
Do you know from this record whether which CHIPS petitions had the warnings and which ones didn't?
I'm not sure exactly which one Ms. Cadwell is.
You haven't looked at the record either.
Well, suppose, since I'm the one that's trying to harmonize these statutes and make them work for the legislature, when the legislature didn't set them up quite right, if you take Justice Geske's example, you'd say, okay, if the last one had it, there was notice, they got the 1 year under the statutes, everything is A-okay. Of course, you can have a different scenario, and that is that the last one doesn't have the notice, but the prior one does, or one of the others. So then there's an element of a kind of unfairness because of the 12 months. So that would be a better case for your position.
It would be, Your Honor.
Okay.
We believe DF should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Cadwell, maybe you can clear up the facts. Don't think so.
You'll have to forgive me. I brought a cold with me from the Northwoods. One of your clerks suggested I should bring cookies, but I didn't. I brought a cold. So, I'm here to tell you...
Barbara A. Caldwell, right?
Cadwell. Many years ago, you swore me in. I'm here to tell you that you don't even need to reach the issue of whether or not DF should be overruled. And that's because of the facts of this case. Mr. Stauffacher...
You read the record.
Yes. It doesn't mean I remember it. It just means I read it. Mr. Stauffacher is in error when he says the children were only returned to the home briefly. They were, in fact, returned to the home in April of 1994, and they were not removed again until December of 1994, December 4th, when there was an incident of leaving the children home alone. At that time, my client was at the Winnebago Mental Health Center. And quite frankly, my client, Anthony C., has pretty much been incarcerated either in prison or at the Wisconsin Resource Center or at Winnebago just about continuously. Mr. Stauffacher, in his petition for termination of parental rights, in fact, acknowledges that the parents met the conditions of the CHIPS order, which was previously entered, and the children were returned. There was then a subsequent incident of substantiated neglect. The children were left home alone for a significant period of time. The county had the opportunity to do exactly what this court has been talking about, which is file a new non-defective petition and then proceed with the proper warnings. And in fact, the extension which was filed and the orders in Marinette County did contain the proper warning. Yes, they did.
So this is after the children were left home alone. The next order had a warning in it.
Right.
So just so we understand, since we're going over the record, opposing counsel indicated that there were proper TPR warnings before this incident in 94, correct?
Yes,
so now
were.
So now, factually, we have those warnings being given before and those warnings being given after.
Yes, but my point is that at that point, the county had the option of filing a new petition. The county then, however, elected to proceed on an extension of the old defective petition. So they made a choice. And it is that choice that brings us here. Not the case of In Re DF, but instead the county's choice. They had a new incident of new incident, of neglect, they elected not to file a new petition, but instead proceeded under the old petition.
Now, and for the sake of argument, I don't see a great deal of difference. But you explain to me it's because this one was defective and they chose to continue, that's where the key is, and that's why your position should be sustained.
And therefore the court doesn't even have to reach the issue of overruling in Re DF. Okay. I'd like to address some of the things that in prior argument the court seemed to be concerned about, just briefly. And one thing that I think concerns me is this court asked, are the parents represented by counsel in the CHIPS petitions? In this particular case, they were, but I want to warn this court that as of the last year, the public defender no longer funds counsel for parents in CHIPS cases. And as this court has recognized, many of the parents in CHIPS cases are not very sophisticated and are often public defender eligible. This is the only way they're going to get counsel. This is the only way they're going to be advised what they need to do. And without counsel, a lot of these things may go over their heads.
Now, however, there was a case, as you are familiar with, that made some changes in that area. This court, I believe, made a decision as far as who made the decision on appointment of counsel.
Mm-hmm. I am aware of that, but I'm just warning you that it's...
What was their counsel here?
Excuse me?
Was there counsel
here? There was counsel here.
Every stage?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Both in Waupaca and when the case moved to Marinette County. Okay.
Ms. Cadwell, what's wrong with a requirement that before a petition for termination of parental rights is filed, that the last order preceding that filing must contain the warnings?
Well, we're here on a continuing neglect or a continuing inability to have the children return.
Right.
And what we have is a series of conditions that the parents must meet, or substantially meet, for return of the children. And my concern is if they are not fully aware from the get-go of the serious consequences of their failure to gird up their loins and meet these conditions, that they just may not do it.
Well,
and then all of a sudden, you know, here we are 2 years later, 3 years later, and they haven't done it. It's more and more hard. I'm sorry.
No. But if you do it the way Justice Cook suggested, they at least have 1 year, right?
They at least have 1 year. But many of these are problems that are severe and ongoing. So, as quite frankly, my client's problems are.
But the county can proceed after 1 year, can they not, on a termination parental? They don't have to give them more longer period of time to file a petition for termination parental rights.
No, they do not.
You were trying to tell us why we did not have to overrule DF under the facts of this case. I've missed that.
Well, in brief,
very quickly.
The county made their bed, they should lie in it. They made an election, they should be stuck with it.
Now, what was the election again?
The election was to proceed to extend the old petition rather than to do as they had every ability to do, to file a new petition. So, therefore, this court does not have to come to the very difficult decision of whether or not to overrule established case law, a case that's been in effect for 10 years.
Well, do you believe that DF is good law?
Yes. And I think it should be really hard to terminate somebody's parental rights.
Okay, then let me go back to a question that the chief asked a little while ago, somebody else up there. Let's say that you prevail in this case, and we say that the statute must be followed strictly, and it wasn't followed strictly, and therefore we agree with the trial court. But I have to make a certain assumption, and that assumption is that these parents, that the child really shouldn't be with these parents, and that the Mr. Stauffacher and the guardian ad litem really believe this, and you know, in good faith. Is there anything they can do to stop the children from going back to the parents if you should prevail?
In this particular case, yes, because, quite frankly,
what can they do?
I've
never practiced this area of the law, so I don't.
What they do is they file a temporary physical custody petition because, quite frankly, my client is in Winnebago. Okay, I'm getting beyond the record, but he is in Winnebago. He's not available. And the mother is gone. We don't know where she is.
Okay, but that doesn't answer my question. Let's assume that they're not there, that they are available, and they're waiting to take the child, but everybody in the world, including 10 archbishops, realize that the children should not go back to the parents. Is there anything that the county can do to prevent, for even a moment, the child going back to the parents?
Yes.
Tell me how I would do it.
They file a temporary physical custody petition alleging that the parents will expose the children to unreasonable risk of harm.
And what do they have to establish?
They have to establish, once again, that there's a substantial risk that because it's a dirty house, because it's cockroach infested, because the parents are habitual drunkards.
So they have to establish facts.
Yeah.
And can that be done immediately so that, in fact, when our case comes out, they can be in court immediately so that not even for a moment those children go back to the parents?
Yes.
But under sub 5, they also have to, 4819, they also have to show that children are in immediate danger. Not just that it's bad, but there's an immediate danger.
Yes.
That's a hurdle.
But immediate danger, I've dealt with all sorts of dirty house cases.
But there is neither parent available.
In this particular case, neither parent is available, therefore there's by definition immediate danger.
But if you have a case where your client is not in the mental institution, she's on her meds and she looks good for the next 2 weeks, she may not be deemed to be, it may not be deemed to be immediate danger. 2 weeks from now, it might be horrible, but not during, you've got to meet that test.
But it's my position, and I believe it very deeply, that if she has gotten her act together, actually my client is he, but if they've gotten their act together and the child is not in immediate danger, then you can put them back in the home, you can give them services, and then when the immediate danger shows up, and it may never show up, and if she's gotten her act together that much, you know, we're speculating. I don't know. I've had clients keep it together for a lot longer than 2 weeks, and a lot of clients not keep it together for 2 weeks either, but, you know, I'm not here to talk about them. But nevertheless, my position is that it should be hard. These are fundamental rights, and it should be hard.
It should be hard, but should it be to the detriment of the best interest of the child?
Well, in this particular case, I represent somebody who cares very strongly about his children, who does not have an abandonment issue applicable to him. He's had contact with these children. He loves these children. These children know who he is. He is their father. He may be, to use a technical term, totally wacka wacka, but nevertheless, he cares about these kids. He loves them. I submit to you that when you've got a kid who's almost 8 years, who is 8 years old, and one who's 5.5 years old, and who knows their father and who has a relationship with their father, is it necessarily in the child's best interest to terminate his parental rights? If we've got someone who's suffering, for example, from chronic renal failure and cannot take care of his children, do we terminate his parental rights? If we've got somebody with a bad heart who can't take care of his children, do we terminate his parental rights?
And you've obviously had a great deal of experience in this area, termination of parental rights, dealing with children. Are you telling this court that it is not difficult to terminate parental rights? As I hear you, you say we want to make it hard. It's very important, and we realize the interest of the parents. as I understand, looking through the various statutes, it would be my impression that at the present time, it's very difficult to terminate the parental rights of parents in the state of Wisconsin. Would you disagree with that?
No, but I would disagree with overruling in Ray D.L., I'm sorry, in Ray D.F., because it would make it easier.
It would make it easier.
You get warning in one order.
Because technically there was a lack of warning.
I don't believe that the warnings are technical.
Well, perhaps that was a bad choice of words, but there was a lack that they were not told.
I think the warnings are important. I think that they need to be given. I think that the parents need to be advised over and over and over again. This is what you got to do, or else something terrible is going to happen.
And you're also telling this court that in your experience, you have had where there has been a dismissal for the very reason we're talking about, that the county comes right back in without an incident, simply on the basis of a dirty home.
Your Honor, no, I can't tell you that because this is the only case I've ever run into where there has been a dismissal on these grounds.
Well,
okay, so I cannot tell you that because I've never run into a dismissal on these grounds before.
Well, I know personal knowledge that there have been, you know, the DF has been around, and I was a trial judge when it was around, and there was some concern about when Judge Brady used the word substantial compliance, that this does happen, and it's not that unique that cases don't get dismissed because of the lack of warning. I'm talking about the one warning.
I think I'm done.
Counsel? Thank you, Ms. Cadwell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Stauffacher, are you going to make the rebuttal?
Yes, I think we have a misconception of some kind floating around here. Having a CHIPS proceeding in progress is one thing. Having placement back to the home is another thing. In this particular context, the CHIPS orders the CHIPS proceedings were continually in progress. At some times, there was a placement back to the home for a period of time or times, which ended up proving to be unsuccessful.
And what did the social service department just go in, take the children, and put them somewhere else?
When they found abuse or neglect.
Yes. Did you have to go back to court to do that?
I would guess that they did. I was not involved in those proceedings because the district attorney handles them. The guardian ad litem informs me that the parents were represented by counsel at all stages of the proceeding. However, I just had a couple comments on the law here. In Jamie L., in 1992, this court used a lot of language about the purpose of the Children's Code, which was commented on by Justice Bradley, and well so. In 1995, the legislature amplifies that. If it was strong in 1992, it's even stronger in 1995, that the best interests of the children are paramount here. And that's what this is all about. The DF case stands for the simple proposition that every TPR that wants to use the continuing need of protection and services ground has to be perfect from day one. If you don't have a gap in the proceedings, you have a defect. That's the way Judge Duca interpreted, and I do not disagree with his interpretation of DF. Judge Duca is one of the finest scholars of the law I've ever known. We had three attorneys plus a judge looking for a way to get around this problem, and none of us came up with it, other than to take the route that we have taken here. It's interesting that in DF, the opinion was written by Judge Sunby from the Court of Appeals, and that was in 1988. In the 1991 published case of KK, the same court, the same branch of the Court of Appeals, determined that the language of the two subsections of Section 48415 are dissimilar, but they noted that if the ground was abandonment, that you didn't have to have perfect TPR warnings in every case. Judge Sunby wrote an interesting dissenting opinion in that case, and in the last paragraph of that case, He objects to the majority by saying that the majority's construction of Section 48.356 stats leads to an unreasonable result. Whenever the trial court enters an extension order under 48.365, the judge will be required to inform the parent or parents of the CHIPS grounds for termination of the parent's parental rights, but not the abandonment grounds. This odd result cannot have been intended or anticipated by the legislature when it enacted Section 48.356. I dissent. The only way I can reconcile this would be that it would be Judge Sundby's apparent position that every ground for termination of parental rights must have perfect TPR warnings. This would operate to take the DF concept and expand it. But on the other hand, I am here asking the court to eliminate the DF concept and make it parallel with the abandonment concept. Namely, if you have at least one good CHIPS order with the proper TPR warning in the unbroken succession of CHIPS proceedings that you have needed. I think that to terminate the CHIPS proceedings altogether would put the children at risk, as Justice Bradley has commented, because then you have to start over with a clean slate. You have to wait for something new to happen.
Mr. Stauffacher, just to alert me as to present practice, as, for instance, Marinette County changed their form so that now it's thrown in as simple, this warning is on there, on the form?
The warning will be attached to the petition that's in your file. The latest one would have it. Basically, it's a whole page full of fine print with boxes to check.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's good and maybe it isn't, but that's the way it's done.
Okay.
I don't know of a better way to do it.
Most counties do it that way? The forms have been changed enough?
I can't answer for the other counties.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree with counsel that the temporary physical custody petition could be brought immediately if you lose here?
Yeah, well, if we would lose here, we still have a CHIPS proceeding ongoing.
But can you? You've got children that are going to be out in the woods because the father's in prison and the mother's gone. Can you bring a temporary physical custody petition immediately, either within that CHIPS proceeding or outside of the CHIPS proceeding?